All right, a couple questions for you. You don't have to raise your hand, but have you ever had a temper tantrum in response to your kid's temper tantrum? Have you ever fought with your spouse or your boyfriend or your girlfriend so long that you forgot what you're fighting about, but you continue to fight because you wanted to win? Have you ever walked away from an extended family gathering, shaking your head and saying, "You can't choose your family"? Do you have unmet expectations for how your life looks like? Do you have regrets about how things have turned out? Here's the reality. Home is hard. We've been talking about this for the last number of weeks, and you are not alone. That the people sitting all around you, people who are in leadership at the church, people who are just like you, struggle just like you, and all of us go through different things, but also we go through the same kinds of things as we seek to be in relationships or as we live as single people, as we get married, as we try and stay married, as we raise children, as we push children out. I was trying to think of a nice way to say that, as we kick children out of the house one day and try to make them independent, healthy adults. We all go through different things in life, different challenges, but we all go through the same challenges. And home is hard. And whatever phase you're in, there are great joys. There are things that I hope that you're really enjoying about that part of your life. And there's also challenges. And I hope that you'll understand as we work through this series that you are not the only one facing those challenges. You're not the only one that sometimes feels like giving up. You're not the only one that feels trapped sometimes. You're not the only one that feels like you don't have all the answers and you don't know what to do and you're not sure what's going to happen next. You're not the only one that isn't sure what the future holds, that doesn't always have confidence in your ability to be a good husband or a wife or a parent or a grandparent or you're not the only one sitting, looking around, thinking life hasn't turned out the way that I thought it was going to be, or I thought I would be in a different place at this point in my life. You are among friends. You are among people that understand that, and you are among people who have been there or are there. You are not alone. And maybe that's one of the most important takeaways that we have in this whole series, to know that we are not alone and we can be filled with hope that together, and I believe with God's help, we can work through the challenges that we have and that we can become better people in all different phases of our lives. If you have a relationship with anybody, which is all of us, you will find yourself at certain points feeling like you're out of control, because you can't control other people. There will be times where you feel like you can't control your life. There will be times where you wish you could control somebody else's behavior, and you'll find out maybe in increasing amounts that you can't do that, that that's not possible, that control is so elusive and really is an illusion anyway, that even though we try and control our lives, we try and control our families, we try and control our kids or our marriages or how our lives look, that A, we can't really do it well, and B, even when we think we're doing it well, we might actually be missing the mark. I want to give you an example of that, especially if you're a parent, to kind of understand this a little bit. But all of us have parents, and so you've been part of this this cycle. There are researchers that have researched different phases of life and different phases of development for kids and how that relates to parenting, the kind of things that kids need in different phases of their lives that hopefully as parents we can try and provide and sort of how that evolves throughout their lives. So I want to walk through a bit of that with you, because I think this principle, even if you don't have kids or small kids, whatever, this translates for all of us into adults. It's important for us to think through, and actually to think through, I think, how God treats us. So stick with me for a second here. The first phase in kids' lives are the discipline years. This is kind of ages 1 to 5. Don't hold me to the 1 to 5. Of course, they're going to bleed into each other, sometimes a little less, a little bit more. But generally speaking, ages 1 to 5 are kind of the discipline years. So as a parent, this is where you're teaching your kids, teaching your kids how to behave properly, teaching them about the world and how it works and how they're supposed to respect their parents and do what they're asked and those kind of things that you teach little kids to do. You need to obey and act a certain way and all those kind of things. It's the years where you're going to celebrate things like obedience and honesty and respect for those small kids. Make sure it's reinforced. It's going to suit them well later in life. After that, between kind of the ages of 5 and 12, as you get towards middle school, These are the training years. This is where, as parents, you want to dive into the why behind the what. So explaining why you do these things and why this happens and, you know, sort of the behind-the-scenes stuff, not just what you do, but the motivation behind it, connecting behaviors to the world and consequences. You do this because of this. You act this way because it results in this. And you start to kind of train not just the what you do, but the why behind the what you do. And then ages 12 to 18, which I'm terrified of getting to. Some of you are too. I'll tell you why in a second. These are the coaching years. This is where you are hopefully connecting more than correcting, although you still need to pull your kids off the field once in a while. I heard a pastor say that. I love that. That in the ages 12 to 18, you start coaching. And this is where it gets scary because this is where I think for a lot of parents, maybe some of you have experienced this, you start to learn and realize, sometimes maybe really, you know, obviously, that you're losing control. So I have two very small kids right now, one who's 2.5, almost 3, one who's just born. In the discipline years, I feel like I have a reasonable amount of control because I'm much bigger than they are. If I need to, I can just pick them up and move them to another room. When your kids are teenagers, all of a sudden you realize you do not have that kind of control. And here's the scary thing, especially if, you know, maybe the discipline years and the training years were a little bit, you know, lacking. You get to the coaching years. This is where a lot of parents say, man, I need to crack down. I need to be in control. I need to make sure that I tell my kid exactly what to do and how to do it. It's kind of the helicopter parent thing. And here's what's scary and here's what's threatening for a lot of people is what's actually happening in their development is they are becoming more independent. You are losing control. And when we try and lose control, sometimes we try and seize control. And then all of a sudden we're butting heads with these teenagers who are becoming independent. But because we're feeling like we're losing control, we need to bear down even more. And we get more and more and more tension because we start to realize that we're losing power. And what we maybe should have been doing back in their early years, that more structured discipline and then the training, we're trying to catch up for in the coaching years. And we all know here's what the goal is. That we can get through those years to kind of the 19 plus to the friendship stage. Isn't that the goal? For everybody. I know some of you are not, some of you right here in front, you are young, you're teenagers, you're in high school. Get this, understand, your parents want this so badly. They want you to be adult people who like them, who want to come home, who want to spend time with them, who want to enjoy being part of the family, not because they have to and because they live there and they can, but because they've moved on and they can come back and do that. Your parents desperately want that. If you're a high school student or a young adult, a university student, understand this. You want this too. You might just not know it yet. But give it a few years. And one of the most valuable things that you will have in your life is to have a good relationship with your parents, to be able to go home and know that they support you and love you and care for you, to be able to go back and ask for their advice because you want it, because you value it. And parents, I think it goes without saying, that's the goal for all of us. We want to get there. We want our kids to grow up to be healthy, whole adults. And healthy, whole adults that you know have strong family bonds that we want to be with. And I get it because in every area, wherever you're at, if you're a parent or if you're somebody's child, which is all of us, that we're in different phases. And in those different phases, we don't always feel great about it. Sometimes we feel like we're really struggling, like we're really tired, like it didn't go the way that we wanted it to go, that we're not doing all the things that we're supposed to do, or our kids or our parents aren't responding the way that we want them to. But understand this, wherever you're at, I believe today that there is great hope for you. And today, maybe that's the message some of you need to hear. If you feel like it's just, this is not happening and my family relationships or my marriage or whatever is not in a good place, I believe that in all of these phases, it's never too late, and God always wants to step into those relationships and to show us how he can transform our lives and our relationships. But home is hard, and all the phases are hard. And although we have that picture that we all want to get to, well, wow, we have a great family, we have a great marriage, we get to that point where we're healthy, whole adults, it can be so, so difficult. But I hope in this series you've picked up a few things that maybe will help you towards it. We started by talking about our values, allowing our values to make our decisions for us, not just to go with whatever feels easy or good in the moment, but to really drill down and to identify some of our values. We talked about taking some of those decisions based on our values and making habits out of them to say, how do we in our homes or our marriages and our parenting, even in our church community, in our personal lives, how do we build habits? Because habits are decisions on steroids. They're exponential in terms of the result that they have when we make good decisions over and over and over, and they become part of the fabric of our lives. Last week, we talked about the fact that we can't do it alone. We need to widen the circle and make sure we're inviting people into our lives that can speak into our lives and encourage us. We need to be doing that for other people because life is too hard to do it on our own. And today, I want to talk about the influence that we have. And if you look through this, if you're a parent, maybe you have kids somewhere in these age brackets, to talk about what some of the greatest, I think, principle is for having influence in your kids' lives. And this principle, same thing in your marriage, if you want to be able to influence your spouse. Same thing if you're single with your friend circle, your peers at work. If you're a grandparent, if you're even trying to back the train up on some of this and rebuild relationships in your family or with your friends, one of the greatest, most powerful things you can do in order to have influence. Because here's what I think is important for us to all get, and for all of us to work towards, is we need to live in such a way that gives you influence and not control. Because control is elusive and an illusion. Because you cannot control people. And even when you can, because I know there's ways that we can do that. We can use our position or our money or threats to coerce people. But even when you can control people, that does not lead us to be good, healthy people. It will not lead you to be a good spouse or a good parent or a good lover. It might make you a dictator that has a bunch of robots running around, but it will not make you good relationally. And I got to tell you, if we're just going to transcend all the categories and all the phases of where we're at in life, this is important because I do not believe that God is a helicopter parent. I do not believe that God is hovering over us, waiting for us to make mistakes, and then to jump on us when we do. Some of us still have that thought, that God is treating me like I'm an infant, like I'm a toddler, like I'm in that discipline phase, the 1 to 5, where he's just looking for every little mistake, and then to, bam, punish me for doing what's wrong, and that we're going to live our whole lives just kind of being scared of what God is going to do for us. I believe God is much more mature than that. He wants us to grow up into people, healthy, holistic adults who are wise in life and who come to him because we love him, because we know he's good and we know that he has what's best for us in our lives. And maybe part of our problem is we think that God is this controlling helicopter parent sometimes, when really he is a loving heavenly father who wants us to grow and to grow up. It's a beautiful thing. I hope you'll understand that and see that today, no matter what phase you're in. I want to look at a passage in Matthew chapter 20. If you have a Bible and want to follow along, I'd love for you to do that. This is an exchange between Jesus and some of the people that are following him, and in it is this powerful principle for influence. And I think it speaks to virtually every level of our lives. How do we want to influence the people around us? And so Matthew chapter 20, and I'll start reading in verse 20. It says, "Then the mother of the sons of Zebedee came up to him with her sons. And kneeling before him, she asked him for something. And he said to her, 'What do you want?' She said to him, 'Say that these two sons of mine are to sit, one at your right hand and one at your left in your kingdom.'" That first word, "then," a little bit of context. If we go back to what just happened, because when it says "then," we say, well, what happened before? And then this happened. And Jesus had just told his disciples that the high priest and the scribes, the religious officials, were going to arrest him and convict him, condemn him, and then pass him off to the Romans who were going to crucify him. And following that, he would be resurrected in 3 days. Just a little leadership nugget for them. Hey, I'm about to be crucified and to be killed. That is exactly what Jesus had just said, if we're just reading this chronologically through the book of Matthew. And then, right after that, it's a little curious, right after that, the mother of the sons of Zebedee, James and John, this is their mother, who is Salome, comes to Jesus, and in light of that, which is almost crazy to think, is going to request that her sons could be at the right hand and at the left hand of Jesus in his kingdom. She here is asking on behalf of her sons for power. The right hand and the left hand of a ruler would have been the number one and the number two positions of authority, of power in somebody's kingdom. She says, say that my sons can sit one on your left, one on your right in your kingdom. I want them to have power. I want them to be in control. And I wonder if Jesus just scratched his head a little bit and said, did I just not tell you what's about to happen? I'm about to be arrested, condemned, crucified. And now you come and say, hey, could my sons be your number one and your number two in command? That's where the conversation goes after this. Jesus answered, you do not know what you are asking. In this, it doesn't come across in English, but in Greek, the you now is plural. She's now going from speaking to the mother to the two brothers. You two, do not know what you're asking. He gets it. They use their mommy, but this is not about her. This is about them. It's a little bit sneaky. Are you able to drink the cup that I am to drink? They said to him, we are able. He said to them, you will drink my cup, but to sit at my right hand and my left is not mine to grant, but it is for those whom it has been prepared by my Father. You don't know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I am able to drink? In the scriptures and in their culture, the cup refers figuratively to one's divinely appointed destiny. When you are drinking a cup, it's, you know, are you ready? Can you take this? Can you be what God has called you to be? Can you go where God is calling you to go? That is your cup. It's kind of like, this is what you've been prepared for. It's what you're made for. Are you going to go for it? Are you going to be part of this? And Jesus is saying, do you think that you can drink the cup that I am about to drink? When Jesus says that, again, he's referring to what he had just told them. I'm about to be executed. Everybody's going to think that I have lost. I will be tortured, beaten, ridiculed, shamed, and publicly executed. Do you think you can drink this cup? And they go, oh yeah, we're able. It seems like a really quick answer for something like that, doesn't it? Yeah, we're able. Especially because when this happens, all of these men are going to desert Jesus. They're going to run off. Some, like Peter, are going to deny him. I didn't even know him. I don't know him. I don't know who he is. 3 times, over and over and over. All the rest of them are going to scatter. They're not going to be there. The women, by the way, they stick around right through the crucifixion, but the men run away. Do you really think that you can drink this cup? We are able. We are able. And Jesus says, yes, you will. Eventually you will. Probably most people, you know, look at this and they look at the deaths of the disciples and of James and John, people who were also crucified eventually, that, yeah, this is something that you are going to experience, that you are going to head right into. But Jesus says, okay, let's get back to the question. You want to sit at the right hand or left hand. You want power. Jesus says, and I love this, he says, I don't even make that call. That's not for me. That's for my heavenly Father. What he's saying to them is that just as Jesus submits to the Father, they will have to submit their destinies to God as well. I love this. He's not asking them to do something that he's not doing also. He's saying, listen, this is not my call. In fact, that's not my mindset. How do I seize the power? How do I sit at the top of the kingdom? My mindset is that I will go as God calls me to go. I will accept what he wants and has for me. Now, will you do the same? Will you submit your future? Will you submit yourself to what God has? And it's a hint of how Jesus is going to change the expectation of what leadership is in his kingdom. It's a hint of what Jesus is doing in his life here and what he's showing them about what it looks like to really influence the world around them. To start by saying, I am not going to seize control, because where I am not in control, God is in control. We might stop and think of that widely in our world, how we influence people, how the Christian church is called to influence the world around us in the same way. We might think about that in our own futures personally, our relationships, our families. It doesn't mean that we're not part of forging our futures. It doesn't mean that we don't have options or choices in life. Of course we do. It means, are we willing to submit ourselves to what God is calling us to do? Can you drink this cup? Can you live what God has created you to live? Will you allow him to be in control when you are not in control? Which, by the way, is way more times than we think. Verse 24 says, and then when the 10 heard it, so just understand this conversation is going wider and wider. It starts with Salome, the mother of the sons of Zebedee. Then Jesus addresses the two, the brothers, and now it's going to the 10, the others who are watching. This is the rest of the disciples, the closest followers of Jesus, this little band of guys that are following him around. They were indignant at the two brothers. Well, of course, because they've been bickering all along about who's going to be in charge when Jesus is ultimately in charge. When Jesus finally breaks through and everybody's following him and his kingdom is here, who gets to be in charge? They keep arguing about it. And now these guys have got to be sitting back and be like, oh, bring your mom along. By the way, Jesus' aunt. So it's like, oh, you bring Auntie Salome here to play the card for you that you're going to get in charge. They probably think, you guys are sneaking around. You're trying to take the power. They don't like it. So now we're all back to bickering about who's in charge, who's in control. But Jesus called to them and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be a slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. The rulers of the Gentiles, which is a reference to the people who are oppressing them. These are the people on a political, geographical scale that the Jewish people don't have a choice but to submit to. And he goes, these Gentiles lord it over you. They love that they're in charge of you. And they take advantage of the fact that you're in charge of you. That was the ancient world. Humility was not a value that was praised. Humility was weakness. The idea was, we never want to be in the position where we have to humble ourselves before somebody else. We want to be in the position where other people humble themselves towards us. We want to be in charge. We want to be in control. Probably not that much has changed in a lot of circles. The Gentiles, these people, by the way, that you can't stand because they oppress you. They lord it over you. It shall not be among you. We will do something different. That's not how we're going to live. We are not going to be what we hate. We are not going to be what has hurt us. We're going to live a different way. And so Jesus now sets up a contrast, an amazing, incredible contrast here. Whoever would be great among you must become a servant, and whoever must be first must be your slave. A servant is hired to maintain the master's home and property for very little money. This is among the lowest jobs that you can get. The servant's job is to take care of somebody else's property, not theirs, and they're paid very little to do it. To put the interests of the master ahead of theirs, basically to live out somebody else's life for them, giving them their life and what they want. A slave worked for someone else for nothing. So understand what Jesus has done here in this contrast. Let's go back to the beginning of this. Here comes Salome. Hey, I want my sons to be number one and number two in your kingdom. I want them to have the most control. I want them to be at the top. Jesus has now talked them through and giving them this incredible contrast. Instead, if you want to be great, you need to be a servant. If you want to be first, You need to be a slave. He has now introduced the two lowest positions you could get in that culture. You want to be number one and number two. You want to sit at my right and my left. You need to be a servant to serve other people's interests. You need to become a slave and give yourself up for them. Just so powerful. Flips the entire thing on its head. You want to be great. Don't think it's about being powerful. You want to have influence? Don't think that the best way to do that is through coercion. In fact, it's the opposite. Max Weber was a famous sociologist. He taught a lot about power and authority, and specifically coercive power. The idea that many people try and seize control of others through violence or threats or with their money or all different kinds of ways, but they try and control others. And as he studied and did all his research and writing, he realized something. He realized that the people with the most influence in our lives, this healthy, good influence in our lives, are not people who have positions or titles or power. They're not the people who are coercive. Yes, there are people who seize power coercively, but in a healthy way, the people who have the most influence over us are the people who sacrifice the most for us. We earn influence through sacrifice. That's what Jesus is teaching here. You really want to be influential in the world around you. Parents, you really want to influence your kids in the best possible way. The husbands and wives, you really want to influence your spouse in the best possible way. You really want to influence the people at work in a powerfully transformative way. You really want to be the kind of friend that lifts up your friends and allows them to be encouraged and strengthened in their lives. You really want to have influence. The people who have the most influence are the people who sacrifice most for us. They're the people who, instead of seizing control, empty themselves and become servants for other people. Put other people's interests ahead of their own. And that's why, if we want to be good parents, good spouses, good friends, good neighbors, seizing power and control will not work. It might make us dictators, but it will not make us good parents or good friends or good lovers. Just dictators. Which is why we need to live in such a way that gives us influence and not control. If you want to have a strong marriage, if you want to have a strong relationship with your kids, both when they're young and hopefully when they're adults, if you want to have a good relationship with your parents, then we need to live in such a way that gives us influence, not control. Not trying to control what other people do and how they behave and what they become, but sacrifice for them. Care for them. To help them become who they are. I think we need to stop asking, how can I get what I want, and start asking, how can I give what is needed? How can I get what I want from my spouse? It's only going to take you so far. How can I give them what they need? How can I get what I want from my kids? Can I tell you this? We've had the privilege over the last number of years to have a ministry to a number of students at Mac. And I'll tell you, conversations that I have with them, if they come, and for a lot of them, it's their first taste of independence. They're on their own. They're trying to forge their own life, and they're dealing with some of their baggage and some of their issues. And one of the things that I hear probably more than anything else that they're struggling with in that phase of their life is trying to live up to their parents' expectation. I say, why? What's wrong? Because what my parents care so much about is that I get into med school, is that I become an engineer, is that I have this kind of job, that kind of career, these kind of credentials. That's all they really want. Man, do you know how easy it is to just look and say, this is the kind of family I want, this is what I want my kids to look like and how they want to act and what I want them to become, and to think so much about how do I get that? How do I get what I want? Rather than saying, how can I give what they need? So that they become who God's created them to be, not who I expect them to be. So many marriages where people feel like they can't live up to their spouse's expectations, or maybe their spouse isn't living up to theirs, and we've got it backwards. sometimes want everybody else to do what we want them to do. And Jesus teaches us, if you want to be great, you need to go low. You need to humble yourself. You need to serve other people. This is the key to building strong relationships. So maybe you'll take a step out of this series that we've been working through. Here's just a few suggestions that I'll give you, and I'm sure you could think of many others that I hope you will implement as a whoever you are, whatever phase you're in. The first one, model. Your integrity is your greatest source of influence as you earn it through sacrifice. And people say, you've heard this in parenting circles and books, more is caught than taught, that we often want to tell people all the things that we should do, but the way that we will influence our kids, our spouses, our families, people around us, is by the way that we live out our integrity. Your character will be a great resource for influence, sacrificing for those around you. Give of your attention. By the way, if you want your kids to have less screen time, you need to have less screen time. That's part of modeling. Put your phone in a drawer and listen to your kids. And spend time playing with them. Get down on the ground where they are and where they live. Find out what they need. If you want your kids to be respectful to your spouse, to them, and to your neighbors. If you want your spouse to take an interest in your interest, get interested in their interests. Model what you want for the people around you. It's just a strong way to sacrifice and to build influence in the people around you. Second, listen. Are you building relationships or expectations? Are you always teaching, telling other people what they should do and how they should live and what they should become? Are you really listening and building a relationship, listening to their struggles, listening to their joys, listening to their dreams, listening to what makes them tick, listening to everything they have to say to you? If you're a parent, there's going to come times along the way, all along the way, where listening will mean that sometimes you're going to hear things you don't know what to do with. You will not know the answers. You will be overwhelmed because you're not sure what you're supposed to do with that information. It is all the more important that you lean in and listen. You don't have to have all the answers all the time. You can take time to get resources and get help. Your kids will need you to listen to them and to know that you'll listen to them, because then they'll come back and talk some more. And along the way, what you'll build is a strong relationship where one day they're going to want to come back and they want to know what you think and they want to know how you feel about that. But we need to listen to one another. We need to listen to each other in our marriages. What are your needs? What are your struggles? What are you going through? How can I be there for you? Are we building expectations or are we building relationships? If you want to build relationships, you need to listen deeply. And then finally, it's obvious, but serve. Look to the needs of the people around you that you live with or work with or relate to. Take some initiative and give of your energy and time and skills. Invest in doing good for others, and I'll tell you this, it's a long game. It's not the kind of thing where you're going to serve somebody once and all of a sudden go, oh, and then we're perfect parent-child relationships, and then our marriage got fixed and all of a sudden it was all better, and then our, you know, everything just worked out. This is the long game. But this is deeper, and this is more profound, and this is not coercive, and this is not controlling. This is real love. And now I want to close this series this way. Just by allowing you to think, is there areas where you're struggling, where you're really hurting? Areas as a parent, maybe your marriage is rocky. Maybe as an individual, you just don't see the results in your life. When you just think, man, home is hard. You need to understand that when Jesus taught this, like I said before, the idea of humility was not really prized among them. It was, we need to get to the place where we're in charge, not where we're serving other people, where other people are serving us. And Jesus taught that we need to flip that completely on its head, go the other way. And it works on, I think, every level, as people, as family members, in your workplace. But understand this, and I think this is the most profound level, that when Jesus was teaching us this about ourselves and our families and our relationships and all that kind of stuff, he was also teaching us that this is what God is like. The gods in the ancient world were not beings that you would like to spend time with. They were beings that you needed to appease, that you needed to sacrifice for, that you needed to be good enough for. And hopefully, if they were pleased with you, they would act favorably in your life. They didn't sit back thinking, oh, it'd be nice to have a quiet time and really spend some time with God. No. We need to make sure that God is not mad at us and not at war with us. When Jesus taught us to flip everything around and become humble, he did it showing us his humility, showing us that God is not hovering over us, waiting for us to make mistakes so he can throw down lightning bolts and punish it for us. God is one who has come to us, humbled himself, served us, got his hands dirty to care for us in all of our struggles and all of our challenges, to really, truly love us. And if influence really comes through the ones who sacrifice most for us, then who is it who has the greatest influence on all of history? It's the God who came to us and sacrificed his life for us. Why do we follow Jesus Christ? Why is it that we really love God? Because he first loved us. Because he showed us that God's not far off or hovering over us, demanding, but that he comes down as a heavenly father and shows us how desperately he loves us and how much he wants for us. So today, just think maybe of the areas where you're struggling, and maybe some of you, you're going through just a real hardship right now and you don't even know how to get through it. And know this, that where you might least expect God to show up, because he's so majestic and he's so powerful, maybe is exactly where he wants to come down and get his hands dirty and to show up in your life, to humbly come and serve you. Can you imagine God coming to serve you, coming to serve your family, coming to serve your needs, to give you the love that you need? That is exactly what he's done. And if that's hard to see right now, I would like you to think back and maybe think of a time in your life where God did show up unexpectedly, where you were needy, where you were hurting, where you were in pain. And now looking back, you said, and then God showed up. And be reminded that's exactly what he does. And be reminded that maybe if you've given up on that, that that's exactly where you can expect him to show up again in his time. And if you can't look back on a time in your life where you would say, that's when God showed up where I least expected him, that's where God served me, that's where God loved me, and if that therefore makes it hard to believe, then I want you to spend just the last few minutes of this service thinking about the cross of Jesus. He's come to us to give himself in love for us. And the truth is that what he has already done, given himself for us once on the cross, is what he does over and over. He gives himself every day for you and for me to his glory. May that be our hope, whatever we're going through at home. Heavenly Father, we thank you that you are so loving. We thank you that you show us this powerful, transformative principle of influence and humility, that what is great in so many of our eyes, God, is even the complete opposite, that you showed us what it looks like to descend and to humble yourself and to give us in love. Thank you that you've sacrificed more for us than anybody ever could. God, help us to respond with hearts that are filled with hope and love. Today, I lift up my brothers and sisters, and wherever they're at in life, wherever they maybe feel short, wherever they're struggling, whatever issues they might be going through at home, whatever phase they're in, God, may they know your care. May they know your love. May they know that you humbly serve them, even though that blows our minds that a God would do that. And God, thank you that we can love you because you have loved us.